The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with the Interesting People podcast. And I am back, part of my series with Carlo Estates, and I'm here with Sherry, and I'm here with Sax. I'm here with the people that run this organization. First, Sherry, I'll start with you. Thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
Well, thanks so much for inviting us.
And then Sax, thank you so much also for helping us set this all up.
Well, I've heard so many awesome, epic stories on Matt Talks Wine and Stuff that I just thought, boy, you know, I can't help but think, I know a redhead who's got an awesome story.
It really?
Having FOMO?
No, not really. I don't usually have that because I have a pretty good time.
This is, in terms of epic stories, I'm gonna just tell everyone a little bit about how this got started. Was Sax and I were talking with each other, and by the way, Sherry and Sax are married, and we'll get into just your guys' relationship, everything, because it's a massive story. When Sax was talking to me, when we were driving in the car with myself, my girlfriend Amy, and her sister Christy, we were enraptured. And you know, in 2023, no one likes talking on the phone. Everyone hates it. We couldn't get off. Like, we were just, we love the story. At one point, in near tears, and then happy. Carlo Estates is really, and Sherry, I'm sure you agree with this, you're an epic story.
I don't know how to take that.
What were the odds we were going to be sitting with each other 8-9 years ago? What were the odds we were going to be sitting here in this beautiful tasting room in Prince Edward County, and we'll talk about some of the wines and trying your white blend and your gorgeous 2019 Pinot and Marquette and Syrah, you know, Syrah-styled, port-styled wine. Like 8-9 years ago, would you have imagined we'd be here now?
Well, the thing is, you're asking a redhead, and I don't tend to take no for an answer, so I would say yes. Not knowing who you were 8 or 9 years ago,
yeah. In,
you know, just because then I wasn't paying as much attention as I am now. But yeah, it was a little bit of a shaky situation. I just didn't really have a choice. You know, people say, oh, you're so brave. But the truth of it is, when your ship is burning, you have no choice but to get off and go into the forest.
So who people don't know, we'll start with you now. I want to go back and forth, and people need to know you guys are sharing a mic. So I'll do my best. Take us to the earliest days of Carlo Estates.
So Carlo was the result of Richard's hobby that had gotten out of hand.
And that was your first husband, Richard.
That was my first husband, yes. Richard, yeah. Carlo, it was always his dream to start a winery, because being of Estonian birth, and his father was, and parents were European, mother English, they made wine, you know, on the regular. And Richard realized at a young age that if he helped his dad make wine, then he would get some bottles to share with his buddies. So he quickly realized it was a good idea to help his dad make wine. And then one day his dad tasted wine that Richard made all by himself. And he said, you know what, son, you're better at this than I am. So here, you take all the equipment and you make the wine. So he did. He met a fellow, I think it's Don Pedagasco, I'm not sure if I'm getting that name right, who tasted his wine up, I think, like north, like maybe Montreal or something. I don't know. He tasted the wine and he said, you should enter this into competition. This is really good wine.
Really?
Yeah. So Richard entered it into the Amateur Winemakers of Ontario competition. It ended up winning silver in the competition, which was pretty impressive for his very first wine. Through that, he met the Pickering Wine Guild, which was a whole bunch of amateur winemakers who just basically taught each other how to make wine by getting together once a month for a potluck, and they'd try each other's wines and critique them. And of course, it was all blind. At the time, there was another winemaker there named Dan Sullivan, who had auditioned to become a wine judge, and they were entering wines into competition and winning lots of similar awards. So Richard thought, hey, I'd like to see how my palate is and see if I'd be any good. And so he took the taste test and wrote the exam, I guess. And the guys came back to him. They said, well, you passed. So would you like to do the 2-year accreditation program and become one of the wine judges of Canada? And at the time, Richard was a partner in an engineering firm. So he said, I can't do that. I have a business to run. And they said, well, you might want to think about it because you just ended up getting the highest score in the history of the wine judges of Canada.
Wow.
You might want to quit your day job. So he did.
Go to the lucrative world of making wine.
Exactly. Little did we all know.
Oh.
Yeah, don't get me started. Basically, when the bottom fell out of the automotive industry in 2008, Richard decided to pack it in early and start his dream, his retirement plan, which was to own a winery in Prince Edward County. Actually, he was looking in Niagara first, but even then it was astronomically priced. There was no way an individual could buy vineyard land down in Niagara back then. And then Dan, of course, had bought some land out in the county, and he invited the Guild to come out for a tasting. And even before that, Richard had come out and he saw the beautiful limestone soil, and of course, just like everybody else, went nuts thinking about how similar it is to Burgundy, France. So, and he fell in love, being a civil engineer, he fell in love with the architecture and the bucolic authenticity of the county. And the fact that everywhere you look, there's a beautiful painting waiting to happen.
By the way, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. The bucolic authenticity, it's a hard word. You'll get a lot of points on Scrabble, but you nailed it. That's exactly what this area is. That's a great way to describe it.
Yeah, it's the land that time forgot. And it's whenever you drive across the bridge and get into the county, we would always just feel all the stress from the city just slipping off our shoulders. So it was it's pretty magical here on this island. But yeah, so it took us about a year. First, we started off by, he was courting me. He would say, I met him on Lava Life because I was really bad at dating men. I'm just trying to give you the Coles Notes story. So my girlfriend said, we're going to put you on Lava Life and you're not allowed to smile at any guy, no matter how cute he is, unless you can check off every interest off your list on his list. So I had things in there like Corvette convertible. He's like, she doesn't care about Corvette convertibles. No, I'm just kidding. But it was things like wine and fine art and stuff like that. And so, of course, it took me about 8 months, but I found three guys that I could check everything off with. So the first one I met, was his name was Jamie, and I started to date Jamie. And then Jamie said, well, just to give you a heads up, I want to be completely transparent. I'm dating somebody else as well at the same time.
All right. Goodbye, Jamie.
No. Well, I said, oh, I guess that's what you do on Lava Life. You're seeing people. I'm like, okay. So then I met Richard and I said, Richard, I'm dating Jamie and Jamie's dating somebody else. And Richard said, I really don't care what Jamie's doing. I know what I want and I'm just going to focus on what I want. So it doesn't matter to me. And I'm like, okay. So I kept going and then I found bachelor number three. And I said to bachelor number three, well, I'm dating Jamie and Jamie's dating somewhere else and I'm dating Richard and he doesn't care what else anyone else is doing. And so I was wondering if, you know, maybe we should date too. And he was also dating somebody else. So he said, well, it's sounding pretty complicated. So I'd go for bachelor number two if I were you. I would if I, you know, played for the other team.
Yes.
And I was like, oh. Smart. Okay. So.
By the way, who's bachelor number three? What was their name?
Oh, geez. You want to cut right to the chase. So bachelor number three was Sax Brickenden, who's sitting right beside me with a ring on my finger. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I met both my late husband and my current husband on Lava Life. And that is the Coles Notes story of how we met.
And by the way, it needs to be said, like, we could do 3 hours just on all of it.
We could do a mini series.
Oh my God. It would be so much. Like, for instance, God, this is going to be so bad because, like, I know some of the stories. I just want to bounce around, and I want to bring Sax in, who's sitting right here. Who's
so patient.
He's so patient. And actually, you know what? You're pouring a little wine, so Sax is right here. Sax, by the way, let me go way off topic for a second. How difficult or just to decide to really focus a lot on Bordeaux blends? I'm going wine nerdy. We're going to get back to the emotional and the relationships and the personal stuff. But the fascinating thing is you guys in the land of Pinot and Chardonnay, and I know a lot of the grapes come from Niagara, as they should, because just a proper temperature. But you guys are like some of the best Bordeaux producers in all of Ontario.
Well, it's really the genius of Richard Carlo, because he realized, I mean, we're now below the 44th parallel. We're at 39.57 degrees. And if you take the 44th across the Atlantic and go into France, it goes straight through Bordeaux, goes straight through actually Cahors, the birthplace of Malbec. I'm sure he was thinking that when he was risking everything and planting 2 acres of Malbec here. He didn't do just a little experimental plant. 2 acres is him showing his conviction, the courage of his convictions. So, and I have to point out that our highest yields ever were in Malbec. So of the vinifera.
Really?
So that's kind of a surprise.
Yeah.
You know, I've had a Bordeaux winemaker going through the vineyard going, oh my God, I can't believe it, the soil. It's so much like, oh, I can't believe it. And then he's crushing this nice piece of calcareous limestone, and he gives me a very serious look, and he goes, but you know, at home, our limestone is 100 million years old. And I said, oh, I see the difference. You can tell there's a male pissing contest coming up here in the vineyard. And I said, because that limestone you just crushed there is 400 million years old. I mean, we've got the raw French materials to do it. We're actually, with the exception of Cab Sauv, Merlot's tricky, you know, we're just doing great with Carmignère, which used to be the Grand Verdure, and, you know, pre-phylloxera, and with the Malbec. So really, it's the genius of Richard and what he chose to plant and where he chose to plant it and how. He tile drained our vineyards, and nobody else in the county, to my knowledge, I'll learn something if someone corrects me, but I don't think there's anyone else in the county that has tile drained their vineyards. But my God, it's made a big difference to us, because when we've been under pressure, like this spring, and also in the spring of 2017, under pressure with lots of humidity and rain, and you'd think there'd be powdery mildew and downy mildew all over the place, we haven't had the same pressure that many of our neighbors have had to deal with. And that's thanks to his foresight. I guess that's one part of an answer to why Bordeaux's in the land of Burgundy's.
Yeah, no, to me, it is really interesting, just on the wine nerdy side about that, because I've seen your wines, I've tasted some of your Bordeaux blends, I've seen the scores, I've seen the reviews, it's remarkable. So Sherry, we're gonna do the part of the interview where, like, you try to make the interviewee cry and all that. And by the way,
I can make you cry.
Okay, well, because Sax made me and Amy and Christy cry on the drive, so.
Oh,
I know, but like,
Sherry's very humble. She, you know, I was going to say she's a determined redhead, but I think all redheads are determined.
Yeah.
So she is a determined redhead amongst redheads. So when I met her in person the first time, it was 2015 in the spring. And but I actually met her online in 2001.
The lab.
So I was bachelor number 3, and it was complicated. I was involved with somebody else, and I was taking my profile down, and I thought, well, this is kind of rude. I don't want to slam the door on this cutie. Wow, she's attractive. And so I'm just going to let her know, you know, I'm taking my profile down. And then she said, well, so am I. And I'm being courted by this guy who's showing me, looking for vineyards and land where, well, actually looking for land where he was going to plant his own vineyards and build a winery in the county. And so, yeah, I said, you got to go with that guy. I mean, this is all typing it into, you know, my laptop at the time.
By the way, that shows a certain level of confidence for you. You're going, nah, go with him. Don't worry about me. I'm fine. That's a boss move. That's a badass move.
Yeah, well,
it is.
Ironically, I got a lot of my female advice from Sherry when we would touch base with each other, maybe 4 times a year, every 90 days or something. You know, she'd say, hey, how's the main squeeze? And I'd say, oh, still squeezing, or... there'd be some exchange, but there were times when I got advice on translating. There was once in particular I got good advice translating. Sherry, when a woman says this, does she mean just this, or is there a subtext I'm not getting here? She'd straighten me out on those translations. And so, ironically, when I actually did get the opportunity to meet her, which was, as I said, the spring of 2015, she came into Toronto to do her first wine tasting event since Richard died. So let's explain that Richard died November 26th of 2014. Cancer got him, and they only learned of this in the spring. He came back from a boys' weekend with a bit of a cough. They treated it with antibiotics. It didn't deal with the cough. Eventually, he's on a CT scanner. Stage 4 colon cancer that metastasized into his lungs and his bones. It was just brutal. And the other members of his family have had issues with that too, like his mom. And so it was, you know, it was devastating. He decided, I'm not going to go back and forth to Kingston to have treatments. I'm going to spend the time to help Sherry understand how to run a winery.
Right.
And he didn't want the last few months of his life to be a pity party. So he kept that a secret. Unbeknownst to anyone else other than a few select members of the family, he proposed to her again. I gather this had happened before, but he proposed to her again and said, look, you know, marry me, because I don't want us to have issues with you inheriting the business that we have co-founded back in 2005. He did marry her, and she hastily, like within 2-3 weeks, she organized the wedding and had a good-sized wedding, I guess 70 or 80 people. And
that's crazy. That's a crazy number.
But here's the punchline. She had been asked by Richard to keep the fact that he was dying a secret.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine going through your wedding with people coming over and saying how happy they were for you, and you had your whole life together, and you're so, we're so glad you found each other, and all that kind of stuff. How do you hold yourself together going through a wedding like that, which you know you've only got a couple of months? So that takes someone special, I think, to be able to cope with that. And then the county was in absolute shock when Richard died, because they didn't even know he was sick. They'd kept the secret so tight. And he was really a magnificent guy. And you'd think the last thing I'd want to talk about would be Richard Carlo, because I stepped into the vacuum which was left behind this guy. And I still joke with everybody. It's taken three men. It's taken really Derek Barnett, Spencer Mayer, and me to make up for Richard.
Right.
So he was something else. And I really feel like he's a brother today. I keep tripping into things he did and thinking, oh, that's why he did that. And, you know, there was always a lot of thought behind what he did.
Well,
and
it's
generous guy with other people, too. Helped everybody.
It also shows just, I mean, it's wonderful, you guys' relationship. And then you guys got married and your wedding photos are beautiful. And I think both of you are very lucky to find each other, because you yourself, people need to know you have had an intense love of wine for decades and decades, correct?
Yeah, I was 14. I went to
14.
I grew up in Montreal.
People Fair enough. Okay, so 14.
Wine on the table
14.
There.
You've been drinking for 3-4 years.
I'm an experienced drinker at age 20. So yeah, I went to Europe with a school group, and then I somehow convinced my parents to let me stay on my own dime. If I stayed in this little pension, I called every 2 days and said, "Hey, I'm still alive, Mom and Dad."
Yeah.
So I stayed there, and the woman who owned the little rooming house said, "Oh, you're very young, and where are your parents?" And eventually she invited me to dinner. I think at the time I thought she was ancient. I think she's probably was about 56 years old, a widow. And she went down into her cellar after she's serving me dinner and saying, "Oh, you like French food? Oh, and do you like French wine?" And I said, "Well, you know, my parents," this is at age 14, "my parents really were the cocktail generation. And their idea of dinner wine was usually very sweet, commercial.
Black
German,
Tower.
Yeah, Blue Nun. Black Tower.
Nun, yeah.
You got it.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it." So eventually she goes down, and seeing this as a challenge, goes into the wine cellar and comes up with a bottle of 1961 Grand Deschizeaux. And I remember when she uncorked it. Yeah. Well, it wasn't that old at that time. This, you know, I'm 66 years old now.
Yeah, so. I know.
Anyway, so she uncorks this, and I went, "Oh, that smells good." Didn't know the terminology, knew what I liked, had the rest of my nose in the glass the rest of the evening. So that turned me on. I came home, of course, after studying it as the world's greatest expert on wine, which, as you know, 14-year-olds are the greatest experts.
Of course, you know everything with acidity and tannins.
Absolutely, knew everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so my parents then always would have me order off the wine list in a restaurant.
How old were you when you ordered the first bottle of wine for your parents at a restaurant?
14.
Wow, yeah. Good for you.
Anyway, so it was
badass.
A thing like that. Then I asked for, when I was 15, I asked for Le Nez de Vin by Jean Lenoir.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably seen it, but it's 50 little vials numbered 1 to 50, which contain essences which you can describe, you know, and help you describe a wine. So that was a Christmas present for me before I turned 15. Sherry's got her hand in the air. I'll pass the mic back.
How old were you when you ordered a lobster with your parents at a restaurant?
Oh. That's off topic, Sherry.
We got to answer the question. Sherry asked.
Probably similar age. Oh, I ate it all the time, but then they regretted turning me onto it.
Yeah, that's wrong. No parent should. Parents should make sure their children have very cheap taste. Just macaroni and cheese. You don't want your child or even your teenager to like lobster and French wine.
No, going into the Ritz and saying, "I'll have the lobster, please."
Yeah, so that's not what you want.
No, and ironically, I'm a vegan now. So the wine thing, yes, it goes back a long way. But I want to talk about all the stuff that Sherry's skipping over here.
Oh, I'm going back there. Don't you worry.
All right.
Don't you worry. And by the way, through a lot of this, and Sax, thanks for sharing a lot of that. Just those incredibly hard times. Those incredibly hard times. Just getting married the first time. The passing of Richard. I could go full Barbara Walters and try to hammer that home 7-8 times for tears. By the way, that's an old reference for people of a certain age. I want to go here with you, Sherry. What was it like? What was that first year like trying to keep Carlo Estates going? you know, after the passing of your husband, and now you're fully in charge. Like, that's asking a lot of any human being. What was that first year like?
Terrifying.
Yeah.
Also very anxiety ridden, because everyone's your friend, but you don't know who to trust. And that's probably a good thing, because it's when your partner dies, that's one thing. And that's hard enough as it is. But the hardest part is what happens after. Yeah, it's just, I'm really blessed that I've had such a strong community to help me out. Like, a lot of the winemakers in the community pitched in right away to help me figure things out and to help put me on to other people who could help me figure things out. And thank God somebody referred me to a really great cellar rat who was basically able to go through all the wines and tell me what had gone off as Richard was dying. And the wine judges of Canada actually came in and they tasted through everything for us. And then he helped to clean it all up. And it was bad, because we had to throw out over $680,000 worth of inventory.
Jeez. And it's not even just the money. It's also the time and effort. Mm-hmm. Every bottle of wine represents a unit of time as well. Not just money, but time.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, luckily most of it wasn't in bottle, but still to have to dispose of that much was hard. And then, you know, like, you don't know what you don't know. And so I found the easiest way to figure things out is just to do them myself. And then once I know how to do it myself, I could pass it on to somebody else. But what I did know was I needed help and I couldn't do it by myself. And I was supposed to be just doing marketing and looking good. I had two things to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew I didn't know enough about business. So I was really blessed to have Sax come into my life when he did, because I didn't know how to read a profit and loss statement, and I didn't know who to trust, and I didn't know how to negotiate, and I didn't know how to conduct myself or like stand or create boundaries or systems or, oh my God, there's so many things now I look back and I learned a lot from Richard. I've also learned a lot from Sax. I've been really lucky. I don't know, maybe I'm charming or something, because I've seemed to have attracted a lot of great mentors in my life. So, yeah. So the short answer, it was hard.
Yeah. No, of course. Of course. All right. So then what, and either Sax, either you or Sherry can answer this. What was the lowest moment afterwards where you might have thought to yourself, and I know fighting hard redhead, everything's going to work out. You're going to do everything you can. And you got Sax here to help you and you have the community to help you. But was there a moment when you're like, oh shit, this might go under. This wine, this vineyard, it might go under.
Well, I guess there's that part where, you know, the Royal Bank calls you up and they say, you know, after you threw out that $680,000 worth of inventory, you're a little offside. So your debt to equity ratio is a little offside. So we're going to put you into this thing called special credit.
Ooh, special. That must be a good thing. The word special
credit.
VIP.
Yeah. VIP credit. But, you know, that was a blessing in disguise, because I was like in entrepreneur jail and I had to do penance. So I had to like report on every little thing every week, every month. And it literally taught me what Sax calls how to see the instruments on your panel so you can fly the plane. And the other thing that was really hard was I have to credit Sax, because my lowest of the low part was when I was like saying, oh my God, we're going to go down, we're going down. But kept thinking about, you know, yes, we're going down, but we're going to be like that tree, that plane that's like coming up on the mountain, and we're going to pull up and we're going to like chop off all the tops of the trees, but we're going to keep pulling up and we're going to like miss the mountain.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The one thing that Sax said to me that really helped me was he said, it's like you're driving at night and you don't know where you're going. So all you can see is like the first 12 feet in front of you, because that's all your headlights show you. So just focus on the white line. Focus on the line. Don't look in the ditch, because if whatever, when you look in the ditch, that's what you're going to drive towards and you're going to go in the ditch. But
that's smart.
Keep focusing on the next step, on that 10 feet you can see in front of you and that white line. And just keep your head down and just do that and you'll get there. And it worked.
That's great advice. That's a good analogy. All right, Sax, when you helped to come and help out, what did you see with Carlo Estate back in 2014 as someone who had made wine or ordered wine from your parents when you were barely a teenager? When you looked at this vineyard and this estate, what did you see back in those days?
Well, there's an emoji, you know, the one with the two big eyes.
I'm 48. I don't.
I don't know which emoji does what. So I'm 66, but I'm talking about the one that's got the big eyes.
Yeah.
And that's when I was talking to Sherry, and you know, this was pretty. Our courtship advanced pretty quickly because we had exchanged.
You've known each other for 13
and a half years before I'd actually laid eyes on her.
Yeah.
And then when I went.
We didn't really talk that much.
No, but I knew you had a great sense of humor. Let's just say I felt I knew you better than I really ought to have because I walked into that.
Because you're stalking me on Facebook.
No, I wasn't. I really wasn't. But the shocker for me, being a shallow, two-dimensional male, visual, the shocker was walking into the tasting event, which was county in the city. It was Airship something in the distillery district in Toronto, which was about two blocks from where I lived. I walked in there and I clocked you right away. That helped that you had the red hair and you did have a skylight above you, by the way. All this business about me having white light over me, no, that was white hair. Anyway, when I looked at you, I went, oh my God, she looks better than the photographs. That never happens.
That's a rarity.
So that helped. Being shallow male. Anyway, so that helped drive my conviction a little bit. And then, you know, I had my first date with her was because I came back after tasting the port style wine, the Van Alstyne Red, Ruby Red, lovely. I went around the corner to Soma in the distillery district, my favorite chocolatier.
Yep.
And I got four dark chocolate caramels and four dark chocolate bergamot, which I thought would actually pair very well with the port style wine she was pouring. And I went back to her and gave her that chocolate, gave her the little box and said, we'll talk later. Because I thought, look, you know, she's still just lost her husband, you know, late last year. And she's got two employees with her. And so we're not going to talk here. So luckily she took that that Trojan horse, went back to the winery, and then I didn't hear anything for an agonizing 2 days, and eventually I got a text that said,
oh my God, this is the crack cocaine of chocolate.
That's what the text said. Actually, it was OMFG, Sherry. There was an F in there. So I thought, oh, great.
No, you didn't. Fudging, I think. The fudge within the chocolate. That's the F.
So
you didn't swear. No, you didn't. You didn't
OMFG,
swear.
OMFG. No.
Yeah. No. You didn't say. Oh my fucking God. You did not say fucking.
You know. Absolutely.
You did not
never
swear.
Never say that on a podcast.
No. And, you should, especially a wine podcast.
Yeah,
you should
never.
Not swear.
Offside.
Unless you're talking about this fucking good 2019 Pinot Noir. Just.
Oh my God.
Just fantastic. Anyway, back to the fudge and the chocolate.
So anyway, I got this text a couple of days later, an agonizing couple of days later, and I said I'll just. Thought to myself, I'll play along with that. I should be cool though. Don't be too keen. Don't respond right away. Six minutes later, I responded and I said, I can get more, you know, like I'm her pusher or something. And
the voice, I fell in love with the voice.
And then she said, well, I'll only take delivery if it's at the Drake Devonshire. 2 weeks, Three weeks Saturday, 7:30 at the bar at the Drake Devonshire. And I thought, well, okay, it's a date, you know, so I was in. She's smart. She made me drive out to her turf.
Yeah,
and,
home field advantage.
But I honestly still feel like I'm still on the first date. That I did go home that night. I was a good boy. Drove home, but it was rather late after a nice walk around the vineyard in the moonlight. And we men always think, oh, what a coincidence. It was a full moon that night. No, I think she planned it. She knew I was a Cancerian. Anyway, but it was very soon after that. We're looking at the financials. Actually, I remember asking you, does the bank know about the fact that you're going to have to write this all off, Sherry? And it's like, oh boy, we're going to have one really ugly meeting with the bank, but we have to get all the skeletons out of the closet and everything out from under the rug. You know, anything you were afraid to present is going to be shown to them.
Yeah.
And then we went to them with a huge, nasty loss. Of course, most of it was related to non-recurring accounting events because of the loss of co-founder. But I said, we're not going to have two ugly meetings, just one really ugly one. And that strategy, I think, turned out to be okay, because then the bank was looking at it saying, well, you know what? It's not getting worse. It's getting better. Every time we reported in, it was getting better. And
so profits were getting better year after year after
yes.
the low moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I think now she's spoken to the Royal a number of times, two that I know of, where it's a success story. They did the things that a bank should do with an entrepreneur and helped guide us. And it was always good for me, because the things that she was being asked to do by the bank were the same things I was saying you should do. So I think that helped. But Peter at Royal was brilliant and helped guide us out of special credit. And I have to say, I don't know of any bank that has done a better job of that.
Nice.
So
that's and then on the wine side of things,
yeah.
What did you know about them? Were you?
I didn't know anything about Carlo. First of all, I was a member of the Opimian. Used to be called the Opimian Society.
Yep.
I was one of the first charter, one of the first 250 charter members in Canada. So I can tell you the Opimian would never, ever have considered promoting a Canadian winery in the catalog. And I had my nose in the air and I wasn't at all, I mean, I'd been down to some great wineries at the time. I mean, in Enniskillen, I mean, when I was in the 80s, we're talking.
And yeah, it's so different then than now. It's so different then than now.
And Don, oh, completely. But I respected what they were trying to do. But I wasn't seriously considering buying Canadian wines.
Yeah.
It wouldn't even come onto the radar.
And what year was that?
Well, that was really until I met Sherry.
Yeah.
And then ironically, we were the second Canadian winery to be promoted in the Opimian Wine Club's catalog behind Pearl Morissette. And so that was kind of gratifying to see that. You know, we were showing up we were picking up medals left, right, and center and getting a lot of recognition. So here I am. Here I am and proud of what we've been able to achieve.
Of course. And Pearl Morissette, that makes some really good Cab Franc.
Yep.
And by the way, you're not alone. We were all there. We were all there at some point about a low opinion about Ontario wine until two things happened. One, we went out and tried it. And two, on the Ontario level, years happened, vines got older, people got smarter. Mm-hmm. So it was a two-way thing that needed to happen, and it has happened. You can find great Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, sweet wine, Pinot Gamay, even Bordeaux blends from even you guys. And you can find great wines that'll satisfy you, and you don't even need to leave 416-905-705, whatever the area codes are around here. Chair, I'm curious, how important professionally and personally was 2021? You guys earned like 23 gold medals. You won a lot of awards. You were one of the top wineries in Ontario. What was 2021 for you?
It was a good year.
And moving on. No.
Drop the mic.
Yeah.
It was gratifying because it was like the culmination of the second iteration of Carlo, I guess. And it was gave us some credibility to say, okay, we've done it. We're making good wine. Yeah, we don't suck. You know, we're doing Richard proud, and we're keeping the bar high the way he did. So it was really gratifying. It was like a great exhale.
How much pressure, and this is for both of you, to make, like, it's funny, we talk to a lot of wineries and a lot of winemakers, especially in Europe, and there's pressure for them to make good wine because their father, it went unto them. They went from the grandfather to father unto them. And for you guys, part of it must be to keep the vision and the passion alive of Richard. How much pressure is there for you guys to make great wine because of him?
Well, I always say, to say that I am determined to make Carlo Estate successful would be a bit of an understatement, because I feel that part of the reason why Richard isn't here today is because of the stress of starting something from scratch and starting a winery from scratch. I mean, it's one of the only industries that has everything from growing the raw materials to distribution and everything in between.
And no help from the Ontario government in terms of taxes, but we can save that for another day.
Yeah. But it was, you know... He used to be my sugar daddy, and then he was just Poe, you know? That's stressful. If you want to start a winery and make $1 million, you should start with two. And if you have to get into the business, you should be very bad at math. All those things are true. But yeah, there's a lot of pressure for me because I don't, like, this sounds really kind of cliche, but I don't want him to have died in vain, because I know part of, you know, cancer is brought on partly by stress, and I know it was very stressful, and I just want him to be proud, you know, like, I don't want it to be, oh gosh, Carlo used to be good, you know, like, I just want him.
So this is the Barbara Walter question. If that was a tree, what tree? Oh my God, that is like,
what?
You need, no, Barbara Walter would ask a question. She asked one person, if there was a tree, what tree would you be? There's like nine people listening that are going to get that reference.
I'd be an oak tree.
Yeah, no, and by the way, Sax, thank you so much for laughing at that joke. Thank you for getting that reference. I wanted to make it light before I went heavy.
Okay.
You think he's proud right now? When he looks he looks at the wines and the profile and the grapes and the variety you do and surviving COVID and everything else, do you think he's proud?
I think he would be proud because Richard was the kind of guy who would be proud of you as long as you did your absolute best. And right. it wouldn't, you're going to make me cry now. It wouldn't I'll matter to him if it was the best of the best of the best. But I think he would look around and see all the passion and the love and the sweat and the tears that we've put in. And I think he'd be proud of the fact that we've done Sextus, which is the whole reason he started Carlo.
What is Sextus? See, we can go more technical to take away from the emotional.
Okay,
for people listening
you.
That don't know Sextus and some of the other Bordeaux blend wines that are here. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, it's a perfect way to put it. Everyone thinks Prince Edward County. They're going to think Chardonnay, Pinot, maybe some sparkling, maybe a little bit of Pinot Gris, tiny bit of Gamay. You guys, though, you're hardcore into the Bordeaux blends.
Richard always wanted to make the kinds of wines that he liked to drink, and he was a big Bordeaux lover. He also loved his Amarone, had a big Amarone collection.
Please don't try to make Amarone in Canada.
No, we're not.
I don't want to talk shit about some of them, but when some of the wineries here, when they do, they try to do that technique to make the wines, I'm like, don't do it, please.
We're not doing it, but I'm just trying to explain that Richard loved big wines. He wanted to make wines that he liked. And I mean, Sax would probably be better explaining the technical side of this, but basically the insight was that we are on the similar latitude.
Yeah.
We're on the similar latitude. So he really believed that if they can do it there, we can do it here. And our limestones are similar. So we should be able to make wines that rival any in the world because our soils are 4,000 years old, like four times as old. And you know, I know it's really sad, but you know, with global warming, things are changing and it's getting warmer and we are ripening. I don't want to talk about the Malbec because I don't want the whole county to become Malbec region because everyone hears this iPod.
It's going to be ages. And by the way, the
podcast.
The funny thing with that is that, not to be too flippant about climate change, if you are a winemaker wanting to do red wine in Britain or Germany or certain parts of Ontario, man, I got to tell you, climate change is a good thing, and everyone, please keep using more oil-based products.
Yeah, if it's just not a good thing. No, but the thing is, yeah, so what is Sextus? So
Sextus,
what is Sextus? So Sextus is our holy grail wine. It's the whole reason we started Carlo Estates, which was to prove, as Richard thought, that in Ontario, we can source grapes and make wines that, you know, will rival and be similar to in terms of weight and characteristic and complexity of other wine regions. We're just newer. So our grapes are younger. Our vines are younger, certainly. But hey, you got to start somewhere. And we just figured if we do this, we're going to make some really great wines that we get to drink.
Yeah.
And we're able to source all six of the original Bordeaux grape varietals. We couldn't get much Malbec or much any Carmenere because
There's not a lot of Carmenere out there.
No. And in fact, he was able to track down, you know, the fellows that discovered the long lost Carmenere in Chile. And then they had started propagating it and sending it up through the United States up into BC. And so he was able to get some. I'm actually not even sure whether he got it from the United States or Chile, where he got it from. We have the only 1 acre commercial planting of Carmenere in Eastern Canada because we can't get it anywhere else.
Of course.
And we also planted the only 2 acres of Malbec in Prince Edward County because it's so hard to get Malbec anywhere else in Ontario. But, you know, a lot of people were, you know, having a bit of a roasting with Richard saying, what are you going to do to ripen that? You're going to put mirrors in the vineyard. But but his research was telling him that it was going to ripen before Cabernet Franc. So he thought, you know, Cab Franc is the other darling of the county. So if we can ripen Cab Franc, we should be able to ripen Malbec.
That makes sense.
And it turns out that he was right. And you know, he didn't do things in a small way. He was 6'4" with a big booming laugh and he was a jolly king, and he would always do things like his idea of an experiment is planting 2 acres of Malbec. I'm just like, you know, there's these things called rows. You can do a row, you know, or you could, even a row, like you could do a panel. Just do one panel. No, he did 2 acres.
The idea to bring in Derek Barnett. I talked to Derek. What was your pitch? What was the importance of Derek Barnett to all of this?
Well, first of all, it was
wine. By the way, I should say to everyone, in case they didn't listen to the interview with Derek Barnett.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be arrogant enough to think everyone listens to every episode. Winemaker Derek Barnett, very, you know, he made wines in Southbrook and Lely and his own wines, and just one of the top winemakers in Ontario.
Most definitely. I mean, Derek was named Winemaker of the Year by the National Capital Sommeliers Guild. He's the only winemaker that they've ever chosen. They usually pick someone in the industry like a somm or a restaurateur. And of course, Tony Aspler named him Winemaker of the Year. But really, Derek, bringing Derek on was not my idea. It was Sachs's idea. And it came up when we had a winemaker. It wasn't quite working out. Wasn't the right fit. He was used to hot climate, big Napa wineries, and we were, you know, we're
that's
like
not,
a little,
that's not here, that's not,
no, we're climate. A little backwater, like, you know, yeah. we're the Soma, we're cool climate. Anyway, so we were up at Sachs's family's cottage and taking a little break, and I was stressing out about how these things weren't working. I could see the writing on the wall, and then all of a sudden, thank God, Sachs is a wine geek, because he got this Wine Geek newsletter that came in and said that Derek Barnett had just left Lely Estates. And he's like, oh my God, Derek, Derek's available. You should call Derek Barnett. And I'm like, I know Derek. Richard and Derek used to get drunk up at Lumiere at the Brook Street Hotel. They'd raise money for cancer, and then they'd go get drunk on Dom Perignon in the cellar.
Good day. That's a good day.
I'm like, I'll call Derek. He's like, no, call him now. Call him now. And I'm like,
there were some F-bombs.
And then I could hear Richard also in my head, because I asked Richard to haunt me, and he does. He said, don't put off today what you, no, to tell tomorrow.
Don't
to
put
what
off
you,
tomorrow what you can do.
Do it
today.
Now, yes. Sparky. Do it now. So I'm like, okay, fine. They're both saying do it now. So I picked up the phone and I called Derek and I said, Derek, I hear that you're no longer at Lely. So I have a question for you. When a winemaker stops making wine, can a winemaker actually ever stop making wine? And he's like, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, I'm just wondering, you know, you've left your winery and we need a winemaker. Would you ever consider making wine for Carlo Estates? And he said, you know, Sherry, I don't like to talk business over the phone. So you enjoy the rest of your holiday and I'll come and see you next week. So the next week he came up to the winery, and in the time it took us to walk from the barn down to the bridge, I don't even remember what we said to each other. But we basically got to the bridge, we shook hands, and he's been our winemaker ever since. And we've never had a contract until the government knocked on our door and said, hey, we have to do the taxation this way unless he has a contract in writing. And I'm like, okay, fine, we'll write it down. We are so, so lucky to have Derek, because he is pure gold. He is one of the most talented people I have ever met, and also the most humble. He's got character beyond imagine. Like, he's just pure gold.
He's a winemaker's winemaker. And Sachs, by the way, good job by you for being such a wine nerd, for seeing that and at the time, I could say it, they're better now, stupid Lely. Not even the owners. I mean, you know, sales happen, business changes. So, but I mean, you guys benefited from that dark period where Lely went through a dark period. We'll say,
yeah,
that.
It's not so dark anymore. But
no, it's,
at the time,
oh, it's way better now. Way better now. Love, yeah, love what's going on now.
Yeah, we can relate.
We have all, yes.
We can relate. But at the time, it was I was a groupie of Derek's. I mean, I used to go and taste his wine everywhere.
Yeah. You
know, his Chards were a benchmark for me. And his Pinot's very, very talented and consistently good. Like, I never had a bad one, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that always struck me with him. Yes, I jumped out of the chair, and Sherry edited what I said. I actually said, Derek, I jumped and went, Derek Barnett! And then I went, Derek fucking Barnett!
So, you're allowed to swear, it's okay.
I know. I just thought, okay, Richard's pulling the strings on this one, because I would credit Derek with really saving our business, because at that time there was a big question mark over Carlo. Sure, they used to make amazing wine when Richard was making the wine, but now what? Now, shrug of the shoulders, we don't know. So as soon as Derek's name was associated with our name, then everybody relaxed and went, oh, they're going to be okay.
Yeah.
I have to say, Derek saved the day, and Sherry's waving. She wants the mic back.
I have a follow-up question. Oh, but finish your thought there on Derek.
I just wanted to say that a lot of people, I always felt watched. When you asked me how was it for the first year,
right.
One of the things I always felt was watched, which is part of the reason I had him meet me at the Drake Devonshire, because I knew if anything funny happened, everyone would see what was going on.
Yeah.
But I felt people's eyes turn away, like they just relaxed, and I didn't feel watched anymore after a while. Once Derek was on the scene, I was no longer watched.
Right. But you were saying, and I'll end with these two more questions, and then we'll end this. And you were saying it before, but it is a nice thing to hear, and we see it in Niagara as well, is there seems to be a camaraderie among wineries in Prince Edward County, which I think is important. Like, there's other parts of the world, France. You know, everyone hates everyone, and everyone's an enemy, France. But here, it does seem where, and I think it's an important thing to try to, you know, the tide, high tide rises, whatever that stupid expression is. How much is that? That everyone is on the same team, even though you're all selling different wine.
A rising tide floats all boats.
Yeah. Thank you, Sax. Yes, so, I screwed that
so
up.
A good example would be we had a tractor failure problem four years ago. I had three people offer their tractors.
That's so nice.
At a busy time, too, when they needed their tractors, too. And, you know, Batista Calavieri across the street from us at Hubs Creek, he's a damn good welder, let me tell you that. We were de-hilling in the spring. We had a problem with our equipment, and he was over here fixing it. So, yeah, there is a really cooperative thing going on in the county. I love it. It reminds me of Sonoma in 1978, because I lived in Santa Rosa for 2 years. I was such a wine nut.
And that'd be so, and then, I bet now, not as helpful, but I bet then it was everyone's on the same team.
Yeah, and people here, they're kind of down to earth. You know, it's like Sonoma back then. I remember they were talking about, well, I'm a farmer and I drive a pickup, whereas Napa, you know, had more sort of aspirational intent at the time. And here in the county, everybody is a farmer and drives around in a pickup, and it's just kind of accessible and authentic. Yeah.
Carlo Estate, you guys are different. There's a lot of peck places. It's easy. Oh, they're a Chardon Burgundy house. You guys are Bordeaux. You guys are fortified. Like, you certainly cast a much wider net.
Here's a brief anecdote. When I first met Sherry, the business meeting we first had, I said, oh, well, here's one of your problems, Sherry. You're making 24 wines every year. And I said, you know, if you just cut that down to maybe, you know, 12, 13, 14. So here we are now 9 years later, and I'm telling you, I won by one. I got it down to 23.
Because by the way, I would have said the same thing. I would have said, no, cut it down. Yeah. Have six.
Yeah, focus.
Yeah.
So like, here's the thing. Yeah. If you've got Derek Barnett and Spencer Mayer as your winemakers, in fact, Derek is the executive winemaker, Spencer is the winemaker.
Yep.
You've got a team, the dynamic duo, who are picking up all these ridiculous length of a list of medals and gold medal scores. I mean, at that point, you just stay out of the artist's way.
Right.
And if they say, hey, I'd like to put this in barrel for another couple of years, you go, yes, sir, please go ahead. Because everything they do, yes, it ties up more money, but my God, it makes good wine. So that's the motivation. The motivation is wines with character. Make wines that are interesting and intriguing to wine lovers. And no boring wines.
I just think part of the problem with Carlo Estates is it's a bunch of artists, really, that have been left in charge of a winery. Because
where's the accountants? Where's the business people?
I mean,
too many artists.
Yeah, it's like there's no corporate overlords. It's just someone says, hey, we've got a hold on this couple tons of this amazing fruit. It's really beautiful. Do you want it? And it's like, oh. Like, we're wine geeks and artists, like, so that's the problem, and we like to play, and we're certainly not doing it for the money, because there's a lot of other easier ways to make money. We do all want to make something that we're all really proud of, and that's something that's really important to all of us, because if you're going to do something in your life, you might as well do it well. You know, that's part of the reason I like oil painting, because it's the hardest to me. I know some would argue watercolor is way harder, but it's the hardest thing to do. So, you know, time is going to pass anyway. So you might as well do the best you can do while it passes.
Perfect way to end this. It's a hell of a story. We could go on for ages. I recommend everyone come to Carlo Estates. A, for the wine first. B, it's a cool location. And three, for the story. Sax, thank you so much for getting this all started and for the work that you did for why we're here today, because you played a big part in why Carlo Estates is alive today. Like, just your motivation, your passion, your energy for it is massive, and that's not forgotten.
Well, I was inspired by listening to your podcast. So I also knew you would get out of Sherry what, mm-hmm. you know, people don't seem to be able to get her to really tell the core story, and you did.
So. It's an incredible story. Yeah, and by the way, thank you, Snacks. Thank you so much. And Sherry, thank you as well. Your strength to be able to, I'm not going to do the, you know, the Phoenix Rise Up analogy, because everyone uses it, because no one has any other analogy beyond the Phoenix one. But the strength that was required from you during a very difficult period, and not only you found a way to thrive and survive, that's also a story of Saks. That's also a story of the winemakers and the wine people in Prince Edward County. But that's also a story of you and the work that you have done, and the energy and the passion and the strength that you have. So Sherry, thank you so much for being part of the podcast as well.
It's an absolute pleasure.
So, and for everyone out there, come check out these wines. They're great. And they're, some of them are different, and there's a lot of different varietals, and there's a lot of them you are going to love. And the thing, you know, in the end, these are wines that are made with passion by incredibly talented people. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, on Apple. I know it's not Stitcher anymore. I keep forgetting. You know where you get your podcast. You go get them. You find this. You rate, review, and try some of these wines. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.